line is that the summary statements in the paper are appropriate. I think it is appropriate to downgrade the priority given to PCBs. We know about Dr. Mack's opinion only because we got it from EPA files after a Freedom of Information request. His final sentence is telling. I'm sure this has not been particularly useful for you, but it is the best I can do. I doubt this would have seen the light of day if we hadn't used the law to dig it out of the EPA. Through this long, drawn-out controversy, GE has been portrayed as a non-caring big business that dumped PCBs from plants in Hudson Falls and Fort Edward, New York. The truth is, we never dumped PCBs, and we never made them. Their use was dictated by fire and building codes because they solved a long-standing problem in electrical equipment. The prior insulating material caught fire and could explode. PCBs were viewed as a life-saving chemical. New York State approved our discharge and issued permits to us for it. What do our critics using PCBs as the foil say about us? First, they say GE has more Superfund sites than any other company. In 1980, Congress passed a law to address the cleanup of sites where wastes had been disposed in the past. This law was known as the Superfund Act. The implication is that we did something wrong. We do have a large number of these sites, 85 to be exact, but the number has everything to do with our longevity and our size. GE was founded in 1892 and has had more factories in more towns than any other company in the world. Like most other companies, we disposed of our wastes legally under government permits when required. At the majority of the Superfund sites, GE has less than 5% of the liability for what was put there. The remaining liability is shared by dozens of other parties, including municipalities, other companies, and waste haulers. GE has taken its responsibility for these sites seriously. We've spent almost $1 billion in the last decade on their cleanup. Criticizing us for having these sites is like criticizing someone for having gray hair. It says nothing about character and everything about age. Another common complaint is that we're challenging the Superfund law so we can get off the hook for our cleanup obligations. Yes, we have challenged a portion of the law. Americans are used to getting their day in court. This is true for everything from traffic offenses to murder. This isn't the case when the EPA issues a Superfund order. You really have only one choice under the law. Do what the agency tells you or else. Otherwise, you face treble damages and daily fines. The law gives the EPA power to issue orders of unlimited scope. You get no hearing before being ordered to do the work. You get no hearing until many years later, and then only when the EPA chooses to tell you the work is done. It's a shoot first, ask questions later law. We believe that's wrong. I am a chemical engineer and not a constitutional lawyer, but I can't understand why in God's name this makes any sense under our Constitution. It denies you the basic right of due process. The EPA is using this law in their dredging proposal. Today, the EPA says the Hudson is safe for swimming, boating, wading, and use as a source of drinking water. Bald eagles and other wildlife are flourishing in the Hudson Valley. The government's proposal to dredge is based on a wild risk assessment. If a person eats half a pound of fish every week for 40 years, the EPA contends that the person's risk of cancer may increase by 1 in 1,000. In other words, you've got to eat 52 meals a year for 4 decades before the increase might go up by 1 in 1,000. Why doesn't a rational mind come to the conclusion that that risk is practically lower than breathing? Never mind that eating fish from the river has been banned for 2 decades, or that PCB levels in the water and fish have fallen 90% since 1977. More than 20 studies, most completely independent of GE, show no link between PCBs and cancer. At the end of the day, what happens in rats does not happen in humans when both are exposed to PCBs. Levels in fish are now down to between 3 to 8 parts per million. 2 is the level the FDA says is safe for sale at the fish market. Think about the magnitude of what the EPA's proposal would do. The agency proposes removing 8 billion pounds of sediment from the Hudson to get at probably 100,000 pounds of PCBs. It would take 24 hours of dredging a day, 6 days a week, for 6 months each year. Some 50 boats and barges would have to be in the river full time, along with miles of pipelines to carry PCBs. The EPA proposes building plants along the river to dry the mud that would be carried away in tens of thousands of trucks or rail cars. After the EPA gets the sediment out, they're proposing to add 2 billion pounds of sand and gravel back into the river. Divers would also have to replace 1 million aquatic plants destroyed by dredging. After doing all this, dredging won't get PCBs out of the Hudson. It will cause resuspension of buried PCBs that will flow downriver. Imagine if someone came along with a commercial proposition to dredge anything out of the Hudson River, tear up the banks, destroy the ecosystem, knock the trees down to widen the roads through farmlands and backyards to remove whatever they were after. It would be an environmental disaster. Why would anyone rip up the Hudson? The EPA itself rejected dredging in 1984, saying it could be devastating to the ecosystem. Nothing has changed since then except the politics, and PCB levels in fish have been reduced by 90%. GE has spent more than $200 million on research, investigation, and cleanup. We've reduced the PCBs coming out of the bedrock under our old facilities from 5 pounds per day to 3 ounces. We think we now have the technology to reduce the daily seepage to zero. Source control, coupled with the natural sedimentation in the river, would reduce PCBs in fish to the same level as dredging might, without resuspension and without destroying the river. One of the puzzling things about the EPA's proposal is that it failed to analyze whether there were less destructive and less disruptive alternatives. This isn't about money. We'll spend whatever it takes to do the job right. To tell this story to the people in the upper Hudson and explain why we oppose dredging, we've spent over $10 million on an information campaign. That caused a controversy as well. There was little argument over the information in the campaign. Activists think we should be quiet and do what we're told. We made some progress in getting the facts out. Polls show that by more than 3-1, the people in the upper Hudson, from Washington to Dutchess counties, are against the EPA dredging proposal. More than 60 upper Hudson River local governments and organizations oppose dredging. The EPA's final decision should take into account the views of those most affected by their proposal. Unfortunately, this issue is no longer about PCBs, human health, and science. This isn't about what's best for the Hudson River. It's about politics and punishing a successful company. Do you for a minute believe that if we thought PCBs were harming anyone, I or my associates would be taking these positions? There's just no way. Nothing is more important than a company's integrity. It is the first and most important value in any organization. It not only means that people must abide by the letter and spirit of the law, it also means doing the right thing and fighting for what you believe is right. On PCBs, we've assured ourselves that they are not harmful to our employees or our neighbors. We've spent hundreds of millions using the best science to clean up our sites and the Hudson in the most ecologically sensitive way, and we will continue to invest whatever it takes. I've seen a lot since that day I saw my mother crying over Franklin Roosevelt's death. Yes, I've become a skeptic, hopefully not a cynic about government. Only a company with great integrity and the resources to fight for what's right can afford to take on the government. Fortunately, we have both. Section 4. Game Changers. If you like business, you have to like GE. If you like ideas, you have to love GE. This is a place where ideas can flow freely from and through more than 20 separate businesses and more than 300,000 employees. Boundaryless behavior allows ideas to come from anywhere. We formalize our freewheeling style in a series of operating meetings that blend one into another. We can be doing a Session C review of managers and power systems, and someone will come up with an idea on sourcing in Hungary. The next day, we're in medical, bragging about what power has just done in Hungary. Before you know it, they have something new going in Eastern Europe. It's wild, sometimes humorous and informal. The net effect is powerful. The best practices and the best people are always moving across the units and driving our businesses. In effect, boundaryless behavior has given us a social architecture that thrives on learning. In the 1990s, we pursued four major initiatives: globalization, services, Six Sigma, and e-business. Every initiative started off with the seed of a smaller idea. Once put into the operating system, it had the chance to grow. Our four have flourished. They've been a huge part of the accelerated growth we've seen in the past decade. These are not flavors of the month. At GE, we defined an initiative as something that grabs everyone, large enough, broad enough, and generic enough to have a major impact on the company. An initiative is long-lasting, and it changes the fundamental nature of the organization. Regardless of the source, I became the cheerleader. I followed up on all of them with a passion and a mania that often veered toward the lunatic fringe. Initiatives come from anywhere and everywhere. Globalization grew out of Paulo Fresco's passion for it. Product services accelerated after a Crotonville classes recommendation to define our markets more broadly for faster growth. Six Sigma sprang out of an employee survey in 1995. While our employees thought our quality was okay, they believed it could be a lot better. And e-business came, arguably late, because it couldn't be ignored. We jumped in and got wet in a revolution we didn't understand. We trusted our operating system to teach us what it was all about. To make the initiatives work, it took a passionate, all-consuming commitment from the top. Beyond the passion, there was a lot of rigor. Not only did we put the best people on each initiative, we trained them, measured them, and reported their results. In the end, each initiative had to develop people and improve the bottom line. The leaders of every business had to be the champion, and timid and rational advocacy wouldn't work. They made sure we got our A players to lead every initiative. We made sure the rewards, salary increases, stock option grants, and role model recognition at company meetings were highly visible. The organization judges an initiative's importance by whom they see getting the leadership assignments. Nowhere was this more important to GE's success than in Six Sigma. If we didn't get the best and brightest, it could have been perceived as just another quality program. We pounded all our initiatives in January at Boca, at every quarterly CEC meeting, at the human resources reviews in April, the planning sessions in July, the officers meeting in October, and the operating plan meetings in November. There was always a relentless drumbeat of follow-up. We used the annual employee survey to find out how deep in the organization the initiatives were taking hold. We started anonymously, polling 1,500 employees in 1995 and are including 16,000 today. We used the survey to help set our direction and as a BS detector. The survey got right at questions about the initiatives, whether or not our messages were getting through. When we launched Six Sigma in 1995, for example, we asked employees if they agreed or disagreed with the statement, "Actions taken by this business clearly show that quality is a top priority." Some 19% of our top 700 senior executives disagreed. In 2000, that dropped to 8%. In 1995, in our 3,000-person executive band population, a quarter disagreed. 5 years later, that number was down to 9%. Making initiatives successful is all about focus and passionate commitment. The drumbeat must be relentless. Every leadership action must demonstrate total commitment to the initiative. The initiative's impact showed up where it should have, in our operating results. Our top-line growth rate has doubled in the last 5 years, and our operating margins have increased from 14.4% in 1995 to 18.9% in 2000. Chapter 19, Globalization. GE has always been a global trading company. In the late 1800s, Thomas Edison installed the 3,000-bulb electric lighting system at London's Holborn Viaduct. At the turn of the century, GE built the largest power plant in Japan. Some of the company's earliest CEOs traveled by boat for a month or two to look for business in Europe and Asia. I had an early start in globalization. Reuben Gutoff and I formed two joint ventures in plastics in the mid-1960s, one with Mitsui Petrochemical in Japan and the other with AKU, the chemical and fiber company in Holland. Mitsui and AKU were large chemical corporations, and our little project in specialty plastics turned out to be too small to get their attention. We had locked ourselves up in long-term agreements. We had to get out. I'll never forget my final negotiations with Mitsui. Tom Fitzgerald, the sales head of plastics, and I were having lunch at the Yokura Hotel in Tokyo with the Mitsui officials. We were sitting on the floor with our shoes off. After a day or two of negotiations, I had drafted two letters of intent to significantly change our relationship. One copy spelled out a clear separation after a negligible payment. The other detailed Mitsui's staying in the deal and being diluted down. At lunch, it was clear that Mitsui wanted out of the agreement as much as we did. I couldn't have been happier. I was expecting a negotiation. I immediately handed them the staying in the deal document. It was only after looking at my copy that I recognized I had given them the wrong papers. I blurted out, "Oh my God, there's a typo." I grabbed the document back and pulled out of my briefcase the letter of intent that would end the deal. They signed it, and we were free to look for a new partner in Japan. Tom must have told that story 1,000 times to show what a dope his boss was. We also got out of the AKU deal without my screwing it up this time. AKU had built a pilot plant to produce PPO and had spent $20 million to $30 million on the project. Their principal interest in PPO was as a fiber. When the polymer turned out not to be useful for that purpose, they lost interest. However, their vice chairman met with me at his office in Arnhem and wanted a couple of $1 million to end the venture in order to offset some of the losses they had incurred. I told him it would take me months to get through the GE bureaucracy, and even then, I had no idea if I could get approval. I said I had the authority to spend up to $500,000, however, and I could give him the money on the spot. He accepted it, and we set up our own wholly owned company in Europe. In Japan, we knew we needed distribution, and we wanted a relatively small partner. We looked at several and picked Nagase & Company, which at that time was principally a Kodak film distributor. I made the deal with the head of the Nagase family. We brought the product and technology to the partnership. They brought their knowledge of Japan's complex distribution market. Together, we invested in local plants to compound plastics for the Japanese market. Today, it's the heart of our Asian plastics business. We used the same model for a deal we did for medical systems in the late 1970s with Shozo Yokogawa of Yokogawa, an instrumentation company. Those relationships and the deals behind them have endured for more than 25 years and have thrived even as they have changed. GE may appear big, but it is made up of lots of small pieces. The success of our deals with Nagase and Yokogawa reinforce the idea that our most successful partnerships are with smaller companies that feel the project is critical to their operations. Whenever there was an issue to work out, our people could get to the top and not have to work through a massive bureaucracy. I remember being frustrated by how long the Japanese took to make a decision, but when they made one, you could bet your house on it. In over 35 years, almost every business relationship I had in Japan turned into an enduring personal friendship. When I became CEO, I spent the first several years doing only an isolated deal or two outside the United States, visiting Europe and Asia once a year to review current operations. Truth is, I didn't put much focus on the global direction of the company in the first half of the 1980s. I did eliminate a separate international sector and made the business CEOs clearly in charge of their own global activities. The international sector had been something of a hybrid between scorekeeper and helper. I always believed there was no such thing as a global company. Companies aren't global, businesses are. I've given that speech 1,000 times or more to make clear that the CEOs of each business were responsible for globalizing their businesses. In the early 1980s, the only truly global business in GE were plastics and medical systems. GE Capital had invested in only U.S. assets. Our other businesses had global sales of one size or another. Two, aircraft engines and power systems, were very large. But these were primarily export businesses with facilities exclusively in the United States. In the 1970s, GE forged a joint venture with the French company Snecma on the aircraft engine that would power the most popular commercial airplane ever, the Boeing 737. It was Paolo Fresco who really got us going. In 1986, he was named Senior Vice President of International, based in London, and placed on an equal footing with all the business leaders, but without operating responsibility. Paolo epitomized the global executive. Tall, handsome, charming, and urbane, Paolo was known around the world. An Italian-born lawyer who joined GE in 1962, he had long dominated the old international organization. As vice president for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, he also was one of the best negotiators in the company. Paolo became Mr. Globalization, the father of all our global activity. He got up every morning thinking about expanding the company outside our U.S. borders. At every meeting, he'd press his colleagues for their global expansion plans. At times, he was a nuisance, always bugging the business CEOs for details on their international operations and prodding people to do more deals that would make us truly global. He was a relentless globetrotter, comfortable in any time zone, always out of the country at least once a month. For 15 years, he and I traveled the world together. We'd go out for 1 or 2 weeks, 3 times a year. We had a ball together, and on most trips, we took our wives with us. All 4 of us became as close as family. Fortunately, our wives became best friends. While we were building relationships and doing deals, they were out exploring the sights and cultures of the countries we visited. If there was a breakthrough year for globalization, it might have been 1989. It began with a phone call from Lord Arnold Weinstock, chairman of General Electric Company Limited in the United Kingdom. GEC had the exact same name as ours, even though there was never a connection between our two companies. It wasn't until 2000 when they changed their name to Marconi that we were able to buy the full rights to the GE name. Weinstock called me because his company was being threatened with a hostile takeover, and he wanted to see if we could help. Paolo, Dennis Dammerman, Ben Heineman, and I went to London to meet with GEC. The takeover attempt was front-page news, and business reporters followed our every move. As we got close to a deal, we broke and returned to our London offices while they mulled over our offer. We agreed that Weinstock would contact me using the code name of our vice chairman, Ed Hood. He called a couple of times and was told repeatedly by one of the office assistants that we were in meetings and would call him back. Weinstock finally reached Paolo's secretary, Lynn. She knew Ed Hood, but nevertheless came into the conference room and said, "I think there's a reporter on the line posing as Ed Hood. He has a strong British accent." "Oh, no," I said. "I forgot to tell anyone that Weinstock would be using Ed's name as his code." It probably looked to Weinstock as though we were playing it cool. Not that it helped. He was a cool customer himself, as shrewd, wily, and clever as anyone I ever met. In some ways, he was 2 different people. Outside the office, he was a great storyteller, charming and gracious. He had racehorses stabled with the Queen's thoroughbreds, had elegant homes filled with great art, and had a spectacular wife. He was a generous and entertaining host. Inside his drab office, he was the original green eyeshade accountant. GEC's headquarters in London reflected his tight-fisted ways. The lighting was dim, the furniture sparse, and the corridors so narrow that you had to walk sideways to get by an open door. The entrance to the bathroom was on a narrow landing in front of an open staircase. If you were waiting to enter, there was always a chance that someone coming out could knock you down 2 flights of stairs. At his desk, sitting directly under a hanging lamp, Weinstock in his suspenders seemed a formidable figure. He often peered over his glasses, hunched over massive financial ledgers. He'd marked them up in colored pencils, circling any numbers that were below expectation. Complex as he was, I found him fascinating on the whole. Our negotiations eventually led to a series of joint ventures and acquisitions with GEC in April 1989 in medical systems, appliances, power systems, and electrical distribution. The agreements gave GE a good industrial business, a foothold in power that kept us in the European gas turbine business, and a 50% share of GEC's appliance business. Later that same year, it was Paolo who helped to nail down our purchase of a majority interest in Tungsram, one of Hungary's largest and oldest businesses. We had been searching for a spot in Austria to build a lighting plant near the Hungarian border when we discovered that Tungsram might be for sale. Even under the communists, the company had a great reputation and a lot of technology. It was the biggest lighting company outside of the big three, Philips, Siemens, and us. Paolo went to Hungary with a small team and began to negotiate. After spending the day at the negotiating table, he'd call back from the Hilton Hotel in Budapest to fill me in on the details. It didn't take long for Paolo to notice some strange behavior during his negotiations. His counterpart seemed to begin reacting to things he had said privately to me on the telephone. Paolo tipped me off that he believed the Hungarians were intercepting our conversations. So we began saying some crazy things to see if there would be a reaction at the table the next day. Sure enough, there was. So Paolo and I began using the telephone calls to set up the next day's negotiations. He'd tell me they were asking $300 million for a majority interest. "Listen, tomorrow, if they want you to pay more than $100 million, I want you to walk out." The next day, Paolo found them more realistic about the price. Whenever we had to make a secure phone call, a GE executive traveled by train across the border to Vienna or used the soundproof phone booth in the American embassy. Otherwise, we kept playing the game on the hotel phone. In the end, it didn't hurt. We closed the deal, paying $150 million for 51% of Tungsram and buying the remaining piece 5 years later. Paolo closed the deal at midnight over a bottle of vodka with the communists. The next day, the Berlin Wall fell. Without knowing it, we had done the first big deal in the new Eastern Europe. Since Thomas Edison put us in light bulbs, lighting had been almost exclusively an American business. The Tungsram deal, coupled with our 1991 acquisition of a majority of Thorn Lighting in the United Kingdom, made GE the number one light bulb maker in the world, with over a 15% market share in Western Europe. Another memorable global event of that year was my trip to India during the end of September 1989. Paolo dragged me there for the first time, and I instantly fell in love with the people. Paolo had built a great relationship there with K.P. Singh, a prominent Indian real estate entrepreneur. K.P. Singh was a true ambassador for India. Tall, natty, and aristocratic, he was a perfect gentleman. He lined up 4 days of wall-to-wall business meetings and evening celebrations for us. After a day of meetings with business and government leaders in Delhi, including Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, a night had been arranged we would never forget. He had everyone who was anyone at his compound for a huge party. Two bands played music while hundreds of people mingled among pools filled with flower petals and tables of food from every country around the world. What a welcome! We continued our business meetings for 2 more days. During the trip, we were scheduled to select a high-technology partner who could help develop the lower-end, low-cost products in medical systems. Chuck Piper, who had initiated the earlier Japanese deal, had been promoted to head GE Medical Systems in Asia. He had narrowed it down to 2 finalists, whom he brought in to see us at a hotel in Delhi. Both were successful Indian entrepreneurs. One was flamboyant, while the other was reserved. Paolo and I loved the first presentation from the more flamboyant guy who excitedly presented his plans. The quiet one, Azim Pringy, came in after him and gave a thoughtful presentation as to why his company, Wipro, was the right partner for GE. Chuck was convinced that Pringy was the one for us. KP, who sat in on all our meetings, was neutral. He thought both entrepreneurs were terrific. After we left, Chuck made his case for Wipro in writing. Paolo and I agreed to back off and go with Chuck's 50-50 joint venture with Pringy. The medical venture flourished. Wipro went on to dramatically expand its software capabilities, becoming the poster child of India's high-tech industry. Pringy was worth billions, becoming one of the world's richest businessmen. For our final day in India, KP had arranged a visit to the Taj Mahal. The night before, we flew to Jaipur. If we thought the first night in India was special, we hadn't seen anything yet. KP was about to outdo himself. We were greeted at the hotel, the former palace of the Maharaja, by colorful riders on elephants and horses. The entire front lawn of the hotel was done up in fresh flowers in the form of the GE logo. That evening in Jaipur, the Maharaja hosted a dinner at his palace. After dinner, just about the largest fireworks display I ever saw was put on in our honor. We walked up long, winding passageways to the roof where we sat on huge pillows and beautiful old carpets. This was pinch-me stuff. This was literally the royal treatment. They really wanted GE to love and invest in India and were pulling out all the stops. The next day, I was struck by the contrasts. Animals filled the dirt streets as our car wended its way to the Taj Mahal. The Taj exceeded my expectations in every way. It was a magnificent structure, glistening in the sun, which gave it an almost pinkish tint. Behind this beautiful creation, sitting across the river, was an enormous satellite communications dish, a picture of the old and the new in one glimpse. The efforts of KP and his friends worked. They showed us an India and a people that we loved. We saw all kinds of opportunities there. After that trip, I became the champion for India. At our annual officers' meeting the next month, I portrayed the country as a great place to make a bet. I wanted to gamble on India because it had a strong legal system, a potential market, and an enormous number of people with great technical skills. I saw India as a huge market with a rapidly growing middle class of 100+ million people out of an 800 million population. The Indian people were highly educated, they spoke English, and the country had lots of entrepreneurs trying to break the shackles of heavy government bureaucracy. Highly developed from an intellectual standpoint, India was an underdeveloped country from an infrastructure perspective. I thought the bureaucracy would fix the infrastructure problems and loosen some of the red tape. I was dead wrong. We tried to build lighting and appliance companies there. They went nowhere. Power generation has been a series of starts and stops. Financial services and plastics have had modest success. Only medical systems has flourished. I was also dead right. The real benefit of India turned out to be its vast intellectual capability and the enthusiasm of its people. We found terrific scientific, engineering, and administrative talent that today serves almost every business at GE. In the early 1990s, we kept pushing our global growth by acquisitions and alliances and by moving our best people into global assignments. In late 1991, we made two important moves. We appointed Jim McNerney, one of our best business CEOs, to a newly created position as president of GE Asia. Jim didn't go out there to run any businesses, but to promote the region and demonstrate to the business leaders the region's potential. His job was all about looking for deals, building business contacts, and being a champion for Asia. He was a hell of a persuasive guy and had a huge impact. 8 months after Jim's move to Asia, we sent Del Williamson from our power generation business in Schenectady, where he was head of sales and marketing, to Hong Kong as head of worldwide sales. Moving the center of gravity there was logical because no one was buying power plants in the United States. The business opportunities were in Asia. Psychologically, the impact on the organization of seeing a senior guy like Del managing the top line away from Mother Schenectady was enormous. The symbolism of these moves shocked the system. Suddenly, we heard people say, they really mean it. Globalization is for real. The numbers would prove it. Our global sales went from $9 billion in 1987, or 19% of total revenues when Paulo was named a senior VP, to $53 billion, or more than 40% of our total revenues today. Another key part of our strategy was taking a contrarian view of globalizing. We focused most of our attention on areas of the world that were either in transition or out of favor. We thought the best risk-reward activities were there. In the early to mid-1990s, when Europe was slumping, we saw many opportunities, particularly for financial services. In the mid-1990s, when Mexico devalued the peso and the economy was in turmoil, we made over 20 acquisitions and joint ventures and significantly increased our production base. In the late 1990s, our financial services business moved into Japan, which had long excluded foreign investment. These were opportunistic moves, but not in the traditional sense. We were there to build businesses for the long haul. Our acquisitions of CGR in France, Tungsram in Hungary, and Nuovo Pignoni in Italy in 1994 involved taking over either unprofitable or barely profitable operations that had been state-run. They gave us new distribution or good technology that helped to globalize our medical, lighting, and power systems businesses. GE Capital began its global expansion in the early 1990s, mainly in Europe, by acquiring insurance and finance companies. The activity picked up when Gary Wendt hired Christopher McKenzie in London in 1994. With great support from Gary, Christopher spearheaded a massive European expansion. Gary led the way in a similar effort in Japan in the late 1990s. From 1994 until 2000, $89 billion of the $161 billion in assets bought by GE Capital were outside the United States. GE Capital Services took a while to globalize, but when they did, they really went after it. There was no overnight success. It took at least a decade to make the Thomson Medical deal work. The same was true of our acquisition of Tungsram. Yet one of our most satisfying accomplishments was taking over three government-owned companies, CGR, Nuovo Pignoni, and communist-controlled Tungsram, and transforming them into highly energized organizations and profitable companies. Some ideas didn't pan out. When we picked a business to crack the Chinese market, we started first with lighting. We thought that our typical global competitors would be the players in China. Instead, it turned out that almost every local mayor was putting up light bulb facilities. Today, there are more than 2,000 light bulb manufacturers in China. Not all the global deals we tried to do got off the ground, and some experiences left a bitter taste. I can only think of one, maybe two times, when trust and integrity broke down. The worst example of that was in 1988, when Paulo and I went to Eindhoven in the Netherlands for a meeting with the CEO of Philips NV. We had heard that he was interested in selling the company's appliance business. That deal would have given us a strong position in the European appliance market. He had become CEO of Philips in the mid-1980s and had some bold ideas on how to change his company. Over a dinner discussion at Philips House, he told us that he wanted to sell his major appliance business, where Philips was the second largest European player, and would consider selling Philips's medical businesses. He wasn't even sure about stain and lighting, even though the Dutch company was our biggest competitor in light bulbs. He liked semiconductors and consumer electronics. After the dinner, we were driving to the airport in the rain when I turned to Fresco. Have you ever been in a room where you heard two totally different perspectives on the same businesses? We both can't be right. One of us is going to get our ass fired. Our meeting led to the start of a negotiation for Philips's appliance business. The CEO arranged for his president to negotiate with Paulo. We agreed to a price and thought the deal was done after spending weeks on due diligence. Then came the shock. Only a day after they shook hands, the president came back with a big surprise. Sorry, Paulo, we're going to go with Whirlpool. I called the CEO. This isn't fair, I said. He agreed. Send Paulo down here, and we'll work it out this week. On vacation in Cortina, Italy at the time, Paulo left his wife and flew immediately to Eindhoven. He spent all of Thursday negotiating a new deal, agreeing to pay more for Phillips' appliance business. By Friday noon, the details were all worked out. The Phillips team told Paolo to go back to his hotel. "We'll be over by 4 PM with the formal papers all typed so they can be signed," the president said. "We'll have a glass of champagne then." When he showed up at Paolo's hotel about 5, he threw the second bomb. "I'm sorry, we're going with Whirlpool. They came back and beat your offer." Paolo couldn't believe it. "When he called me around midnight, I was shocked. Having Phillips shake on a deal once and walk was bad enough. The second negotiation was beyond anything I'd seen in a top-level business deal. The nice thing is that in 20-plus years as CEO and literally thousands of acquisitions, partnerships, and deals, this happened rarely and only once as blatantly as that time in Eindhoven. Like our other initiatives, the seed bloomed into a garden. We moved from thinking of globalization in terms of markets to thinking of it in terms of sourcing products and components, and finally, tapping the intellectual capital of countries. Take India. I was optimistic about the country's brain power, but our use of it has far outpaced my wildest dreams. The scientific and technical talent in India to do software development, design work, and basic research is incredible. We opened a central $30 million R&D center in 2000, have gone to the second phase, and will more than triple our investment when it's complete in 2002. It will be the largest multidisciplinary research facility in GE worldwide, eventually employing more than 3,000 engineers and scientists. Today, we have over 1,000, including 250 PhDs. India has a wealth of highly educated people who can do many different things very well. GE Capital moved its customer service centers to Delhi, and the results have been sensational. Our Indian global customer centers have had better quality, lower costs, better collection rates, and greater customer acceptance than our comparable operations in the United States and Europe. All the GE industrial businesses have followed GE Capital there. We took Peter Drucker's advice. We moved the GE back rooms in the United States to the front room in India. We can hire a level of talent in India for customer service and collection work that would be impossible to attract in the United States. Customer call centers in the United States are plagued by heavy turnover. In India, these are sought-after jobs. Some contend that globalization hurts developing countries and their people. I see it differently. Globalization never looks better than when you see the bright faces of the people whose lives have been measurably improved for having these jobs. In recent years, our globalization initiative has increasingly put a global face on the company as more local nationals take on leadership roles. In the early years of globalization, we had to use U.S. expatriates. They were critical to our successful start, but we were having trouble getting off this crutch. We accelerated the development of a global face for GE by forcing a rigorous reduction of U.S. expatriates. We got two benefits from measuring the monthly reduction of expatriates by business. First, more locals had to be promoted faster to key jobs. Second, in the first year of doing this, we reduced our expenses by over $200 million. When we have someone from the United States and Japan on a $150,000 salary, it cost the company over $500,000. I constantly reminded our business leaders, would you rather have 3 to 4 smart University of Tokyo graduates who know the country and the language, or a friend of yours from down the hall? Globalization took a big step forward with an exciting promotion that showed our efforts are paying off. Yoshiaki Fujimori, a 1975 Tokyo University graduate, joined us in business development in 1986. Fuji was promoted in May 2001 from head of Medical Systems Asia to president and CEO of GE Plastics in Pittsfield. He is the first Japanese national to lead a global GE business, a long way from the plastics business I started in 40 years ago. Chapter 20. Growing services. Like just about everything at GE, growing services was all about people. With the exception of our medical business, most of the people making the heavy hardware in the company thought of services as the aftermarket, supplying spare and replacement parts for the aircraft engines, locomotives, and power generation equipment we sold. Aftermarket, the name itself, puts it in the back seat. In our big equipment businesses, the engineers like to spend their time on the newest, the fastest, and the most powerful. They didn't think much about the aftermarket. They weren't alone. Our salespeople also focused primarily on the customer's new equipment needs. We had been pushing services without great success. When Three Mile Island forced our nuclear business to stop building new reactors, they had to build a service company to survive. They did it and transformed the nature of their business, getting double-digit earnings growth in a virtually no-growth market. Medical has always had a strong service focus. The primary buyers were the radiologists, and they were also the ongoing users of the equipment. From the first introduction of our CT scanner in 1976, we sold our machines under the Continuum banner. That slogan was meant to show radiologists that a software upgrade would get them to the next generation model. They wouldn't have to throw away a $1 million machine and start all over again. The Continuum concept helped increase service revenues and equipment market share as customers got longer lives out of their investments. John Tranney, who became medical CEO in 1986, built on that early foundation. He was a strong leader with an obsession for making the numbers. John saw services as an even bigger opportunity. Medical Systems was the first business to introduce long-term service contracts. It was also the only business doing remote diagnostics. Medical set up global facilities to give 24/7 remote diagnosis of their installed equipment. Customers from anywhere in the world could get an answer and often a fix directly online from a technical rep in Paris, Tokyo, or Milwaukee, depending on the time zone. With an equal focus on service as original equipment, Medical got results. Overall, medical revenues grew 12-fold from 1980 to 2000. Services were a big part of the growth, going from 18% of total medical revenues in 1980 to 31% in 1990 and to 41% of their $7 billion-plus revenues in 2000. Other than those two businesses, we weren't having much success. The Crotonville class that challenged us to redefine our markets in 1995 was a turning point. When other businesses defined their markets more broadly, the importance of services was self-evident. At Boca in January 1996, I made the point that we had been a new socket company to a fault. We might have scores of executives debating whether we'd sell 50 or 58 gas turbines or several hundred aircraft engines a year, while we routinely handle the service opportunities for an installed base of 10,000 existing turbines and 9,000 jet engines. That had to change. After the Crotonville class, we held a special session C in November of 1995 to focus on services staffing. We made our first big unconventional organizational move in aircraft engines in January 1996. We created a new vice president of engine services and made the business a separate P&L center. We put a real change agent in the job, a true bull in the china shop, Bill Vereshi, who had been the chief financial officer of the aircraft engine business. Bill was loud, opinionated, and tough-minded, just what I thought might make the initiative come alive. He hired Jeff Bornstein, a young finance star from the audit staff who, like his boss, wasn't afraid to take a swing at anything in his way. Bill and Jeff spent most of 1996 putting all the services pieces together. They had several building blocks to work with. We had engine service shops located around the world. We acquired a large shop in Wales from British Airways in 1991 as part of a deal to sell BA our new GE90 engines. It was an unprofitable operation that primarily serviced and overhauled Rolls-Royce engines, and British Airways wanted out of it. This shop was our first significant foray into servicing other manufacturers' engines. In 1996, Bill, with Dennis Dammerman's help, acquired Selma, a former state-owned service shop in Brazil that had been privatized. It gave us the capability to service Pratt & Whitney engines. 2 years later, we'd buy Varig's Brazilian service shop, which would give us the capability to service GE engines at a lower cost. In late 1996, the engine service business had $3 billion in revenues, up from $2.2 billion in 1994, and was on a good trajectory. However, the industry was starting to consolidate. In 1996, Greenwich Air Services in Miami had bought out Avial, a jet engine overhaul operation. I asked Bill and others why we didn't buy them. In mid-February of 1997, Greenwich was at it again, announcing their plans to buy another services company, UNC. I called Bill again and asked, what the hell is going on? This new acquisition made Greenwich a big player. I wanted a hard look at them. 10 days after Greenwich announced its deal, I had a video conference with aircraft engine CEO Gene Murphy and Bill Vareshi to find out what it would take to buy Greenwich. Bill was digesting Selma and thought we had enough facilities and could grow the business on our own. But the more I thought about it, the more frantic I became. I didn't want to take the chance that one of our competitors would buy Greenwich before us. I urged Gene and Bill to think about it overnight and arranged a follow-up video conference the next day. At this session, they agreed to take a shot at it. Vareshi, who had known Greenwich founder and CEO Gene Canese for some time, agreed to call him to set up a Sunday morning meeting for us. When I left the video conference with Dennis Dammerman, I grabbed him by the arm and said, "We just have to get this thing." He was as enthusiastic as I was. On March 2nd, I flew down to Miami and went with Bill Vareshi to meet Gene Canese at his home. He was a gregarious bear of a guy, a clever entrepreneur who had built his company from scratch. As we sat down over coffee in his dining room, it was obvious he was interested in selling. Though Gene didn't say it outright, I had the feeling that after he had put this service network together, he was thinking, "Where the hell have you guys been?" That morning, we talked about a deal, and with Greenwich stock trading at $23 per share, I made an offer to buy the company for $27 a share. Gene countered at $35, and as you can imagine, we ended up at $31 after a couple of hours. Over the week, our teams did the due diligence. Dennis showed up at midweek to keep things moving. The next weekend, I went back down and we did the usual haggling on Friday and Saturday nights over last-minute details. The deal came to $1.5 billion. When I called Canese shrewd, I wasn't just casually throwing out a line. Gene wanted to be sure he got GE stock for his equity. He did, and since the deal closed, the price of the stock has tripled. The deal really put us on the map in aircraft services, increasing revenues by 60% overnight. With Greenwich, we now had a real business with over $5 billion in revenues. Bill had to take the business to the next level. To do that, he had to upgrade the overall organization. More specifically, he had to get the engineering mindset away from designing new engines to upgrading the installed base of engines. We moved one of the best design engineers in the business, Vic Simon, from his design job to head of engineering for services. We also gave Bill a young, high-potential manufacturing manager, Ted Torbeck from GE Transportation, as manufacturing manager for services and upgraded the position to corporate vice president. Both moves reinforced the message that services were important. Services went from under 40% of total aircraft engine revenues in 1994 to over 60% in 2000. We used the same model and had the same results in power systems and transportation. Now we needed to broaden our base. To spread the learning, we launched a council in 1996, bringing to Fairfield on a quarterly basis all of GE's service leaders. Either Vice Chairman Paolo Fresco or I would be at every meeting. Once again, it became immediately obvious who was delivering and who wasn't, and the next session usually corrected that. Idea sharing was particularly helpful in stirring up interest in acquisitions and structuring long-term service agreements. Acquisitions played a big role in service growth. From 1997 through 2000, Medical Systems acquired 40 service companies, Power Systems 31, and Aircraft Engines 17. Even Transportation got into the acquisition game in 2000, paying $400 million for Harmon Industries, a Kansas City railway signaling and service company. Three separate businesses, transportation, power, and aircraft, set up 50-50 joint ventures with Harris Corporation, a high-tech aerospace company. It was another great example of idea sharing. These information systems ventures let railroad companies know the location of a train or let a utility company learn where it was having grid problems. We've since amicably bought out Harris's 50% in 2001 in power and transportation. We pounded the idea of more technology investment at every step of the operating system. The businesses delivered, in most cases, tripling our investments in service technology R&D to $500 million annually by 2000. Investing heavily in technology for services has changed the fundamentals of our service business. Long-term service agreements wouldn't be possible without these large investments in technology and our Six Sigma commitment. Taking on long-term agreements required sophisticated models to predict the reliability costs over 10 to 15 years. Since the business leaders have to eat any shortfalls if the equipment doesn't perform as predicted, these contracts also reinforce the push to allocate more dollars to services technology. These technology investments have greatly increased our intimacy with customers. The service upgrades that we provide today allow our customers to get increased productivity and longer lives for their installed equipment. Doing this, we've learned a lot. Some of our earlier technological upgrades were too sophisticated. Payback times for customers were measured in 3 to 5 years instead of the 1 to 2 or less that they needed to justify their investment. We've fixed that and now focus on rapid customer payback solutions across every business, whether it's increasing the life of a jet engine, improving the power output of a utility plant, or increasing the throughput of patients for a CT machine. For example, Southwest Airlines in 2001 placed an order with us for 300 upgrade kits at $1 million each to increase the life and fuel efficiency of engines on several older versions of their Boeing 737s. As always, the litmus test of how an initiative works is the numbers. Our product services business grew from $8 billion in 1995 to $19 billion in 2001 and should grow to $80 billion by 2010. Our long-term service backlog has grown tenfold, from $6 billion in 1995 to $62 billion in 2001. Today, we're spending as much time ensuring our installed sockets are increasingly productive as we are in finding new sockets. Chapter 21, Six Sigma and Beyond. In 20 years as CEO, I missed only one corporate executive council meeting. It was in June 1995, one of the most important meetings we ever had. I had invited my friend and former colleague, Larry Bossidy, then CEO of Allied Signal, to come to Crotonville to talk about Six Sigma quality. There was a good excuse for my not being there. I was home in bed recovering from open-heart surgery. After returning from India in late January, I couldn't stop feeling tired all the time. I thought I'd just caught some kind of bug that was making me feel lousy. I never took an afternoon nap in my life, but I started taking them on the couch in my office. I went to doctors all over New York, and I must have had every test ever invented. They never found anything. My complaining continued, so much so that Jane went to my doctor, described the symptoms, and walked out with a prescription for nitroglycerin pills, just in case. One Saturday night in late April, Jane and I went out with our friends, the Lofriscos, for dinner at Spazzi's in Fairfield. We ate a lot of pizza and consumed plenty of wine. Jane and I got home late and went straight upstairs. While brushing my teeth in the bathroom, I felt a bomb hit me in the chest. I'd had chest pains in the past, and with my family history of heart trouble, I'd imagined heart attacks at least 20 times before. But this was like nothing I had ever experienced. This wasn't a little angina or a sore arm. This was the real thing. It felt like a massive rock sitting on my chest. I yelled for Jane, and she came into the bathroom and surprised me with the nitro pills. I slipped one under my tongue. Fairly quickly, I got some relief. Then my impatience took over. Instead of calling 911, I told Jane to get the car so we could drive straight to Bridgeport Hospital, where she served on the Board of Trustees. On the way, barreling up Route 25, I spotted a hospital sign and shouted for Jane to get off at the next exit. It turned out not to be for Bridgeport Hospital, but rather St. Vincent's Medical Center in Bridgeport. When Jane sped through a red light, a cop stopped us. After we explained what was going on, he escorted us to the hospital with flashing lights and siren. When Jane pulled up to the emergency room at 1 a.m., I rushed out of the car, ran through a crowded waiting area, and jumped onto an empty gurney. "I'm dying," I yelled. "I'm dying." That got the nurse's attention, and they had me on intravenous nitro quickly. The pain subsided. Tests confirmed I had suffered a heart attack. On Tuesday, May 2nd, Dr. Robert Caserta did an angioplasty to open up my main artery. Bob was a sports nut, a UConn and Yankees fan. Since I went to UMass and was a Red Sox diehard, we had a lot to argue about. Shortly after the procedure, I was back in my hospital room when the rock landed on my chest again. The vein had closed. I was having another heart attack. As they rushed me down to the cardiac room for another procedure, a priest wanted to give me the last rites. I watched on the monitor and saw Dr. Caserta having trouble trying to reopen the vein. The surgeon was standing by to do the bypass that I dreaded. "Don't give up," I shouted. "Keep trying." I was being a pain in the butt again, giving orders, but fortunately, the doctor stayed with it. He got the vein open, and I didn't need the surgery at that time. When I left the hospital in 3 or 4 days, I called a number of people for advice, including Henry Kissinger and Michael Eisner of Disney, who both had had bypass operations. Michael was encouraging, telling me that surgery was no big deal. Henry strongly pushed for having it done at Massachusetts General Hospital. So did Dr. Saul Mills, GE's medical director, who flew to Boston with the films of my angioplasty. Saul was a saint and a wonderful doctor. For years, I had bugged him with my chest pains and perceived heart attacks. Saul had to put up with three of the world's biggest hypochondriacs, Larry Bossidy, Paolo Fresco, and me. All of us carried a pharmacy of pills wherever we went and were always ready to call the doctor at a moment's notice to complain about every ache and pain. Together, we probably have been more responsible for GE's increasing medical costs than 100 other employees. For the last several years, Saul's task has fallen to our current medical director, Dr. Bob Galvin, and his partner, Dr. Ken Grossman. On May 10, 1995, in the middle of a business meeting with Paolo and Bill Connedy in my family room at home, Saul arrived with not-so-good news. He told me the films confirmed that I'd need open-heart surgery. He made an appointment for me to go to Mass General the next day and have the operation a day later. The suddenness of it all was actually a break. With my family's history and my angina over the last 15 years, I had been dreading this moment, but I didn't have much time to think about it. On Wednesday night, I called the kids and told them the news. On Thursday, I was in Boston with Saul and Jane to meet Dr. Kerry Akins, who would do the surgery. Jane remembers more about that Thursday night than I do. As she tells the story, at one point at 4 a.m. in the hospital, I turned to her and said, "If something goes wrong, don't let them pull the plug. Even if they can't tell, I want you to know I'll be fighting like hell in here." Nothing went wrong. In fact, everything went right. I was lucky to have a great surgeon. Kerry performed a quintuple bypass in 3 hours. Since then, he and I have become very good friends. We see each other once or twice a year outside the hospital. Bypass surgery knocks you for a loop at first. Every part of you hurts like hell. Fortunately, you feel a lot better every day. I returned to the office on July 5th, and I was back on the golf course by the end of the month. In mid-August, I won my first 3 matches but lost in the 36-hole finals of the Sankaty Head Club Championship in Nantucket. When I was home recuperating from the surgery, Larry Bossidy called and suggested that he withdraw from the CEC meeting in June. He was concerned it might look like he was coming back to GE with me on the sidelines. I appreciated his sensitivity and told him not to worry. Go give them everything you've got on Six Sigma. I sensed we might be at an important moment. I knew Larry was the perfect person to help. For years as colleagues, neither of us had been fans of the quality movement. We both felt that the earlier quality programs were too heavy on slogans and light on results. In the early 1990s, we flirted with a Deming program in our aircraft engine business. I didn't buy it as a company-wide initiative because I thought it was too theoretical. The rumblings within GE were unmistakable. In our April 1995 employee survey, quality emerged as a concern of many employees. The new Larry had become fervent about Six Sigma. He said for most companies, the average was 35,000 defects per million operations. Getting to a Six Sigma quality level means that you have fewer than 3.4 defects per million operations in a manufacturing or service process. That's 99.99966% of perfection. In industry, things generally go right about 97 times out of 100. That's between 3 and 4 sigma. For example, quality like this means 5,000 incorrect surgical operations per week, 20,000 lost articles of mail per hour, and hundreds of thousands of wrong drug prescriptions filled per year. Not much fun to think about. By all accounts, Larry made a great pitch to our troops. He demonstrated that Allied got real cost savings, not just feel-good benefits. Our team loved what he said, and I received positive phone calls from several attendees. I came back to work and concluded, Larry really loved Six Sigma. The team thought it was right, and I had the survey which said quality was a problem at GE. Once everything came together, I went nuts about Six Sigma and launched it. We put two guys on it, Gary Reiner, head of corporate initiatives, and Bob Nelson, my longtime financial analyst, ran a cost-benefit analysis. They showed that if GE was running at 3 to 4 Sigma, the cost-saving opportunity of raising this quality to 6 Sigma was somewhere between $7 and $10 billion. This amounted to a huge number, 10% to 15% of sales. With that opportunity, it wasn't rocket science for us to decide to take a big swing at 6 Sigma. As with each of our major initiatives, when we decided to go forward, we did so with a vengeance. The first thing we did was appoint Gary Reiner as permanent head of Six Sigma. With his clear thinking and relentless focus, he was the perfect bridge to transmit our passion into the program. We then brought in Michael Harry, a former Motorola manager who was running the Six Sigma Academy in Scottsdale, Arizona. If there is a Six Sigma zealot, Harry's the guy. We invited him to our annual officers' meeting in Crotonville in October. I canceled our usual golf outing, a symbolic gesture if there ever was one, so that 170 of us could listen to Harry talk about his program. For 4 solid hours, he jumped excitedly from one easel to another, writing down all kinds of statistical formulas. I couldn't tell if he was a madman or a visionary. Most of the crowd, including me, didn't understand much of the statistical language. Nonetheless, Harry's presentation succeeded in capturing our imagination. He had given us enough practical examples to show there was something to this. Most left the session that day somewhat frustrated with our lack of statistical comprehension, but excited about the program's possibilities. The discipline from the approach was particularly appealing to the engineers in the room. I sensed it was a lot more than statistics for engineers, but I didn't have any idea just how much more it would become. The big myth is that Six Sigma is about quality control and statistics. It is that, but it's a hell of a lot more. Ultimately, it drives leadership to be better by providing tools to think through tough issues. At Six Sigma's core is an idea that can turn a company inside out, focusing the organization outward on the customer. We rolled out the Six Sigma program at Boca in January 1996. "We can wait no longer," I said. "Everyone in this room must lead the quality charge. There can be no spectators on this. What took Motorola 10 years, we must do in 5, not through shortcuts, but in learning from others." I thought the short-range financial impact alone would justify the program. Longer range, I thought it could be even bigger. In my Boca close, I called Six Sigma the most ambitious undertaking the company had ever taken on. Quality can truly change GE from one of the great companies to absolutely the greatest company in world business. Once again, I was going over the top. We left Boca that year really psyched to make Six Sigma a big hit. We told the business CEOs to make their best people Six Sigma leaders.